Welcome to the Dense City Podcast, a show where we translate academic knowledge one paper at a time. I'm your host, Becca Mayers. On today's episode, we welcome Dr. Timothy Ross, who's a scientist with the Bloorview Research Institute at Holland Bloorview Kids Rehabilitation Hospital in Toronto, Canada, where he leads the engagement and planning for the Inclusive Communities Lab, or EPIC Lab. Tim is also an assistant professor in the Department of Geography and Planning and Rehabilitation Sciences Institute at the University of Toronto, as well as a professional planner. Tim's research is focused on understanding the experiences and critical perspectives of families living with childhood disability and using their input to advance the accessibility and inclusion they experience within their communities. His recent work has explored, amongst other things, the school travel experiences of disabled children and their families, and the design and experiences of inclusive playgrounds across Canada. Today we're talking about his paper, Engaging Disability Theory in Planning Practice. This paper was recently published in the Journal of Planning Education and Research with co-authors Ronald Buehling, Tanya Tichkowski, and Paul Hess. In this paper, five disability perspectives are discussed, with the goal of providing planners with a disability theory toolkit. First, the medical model, then we move on to the social, then biopsychosocial model, a neoliberal viewpoint, and then a critical ableist studies lens. The authors encourage planners to embrace disability theory and the complexity of disability experiences, and work towards unsettling this normalcy of disabled people's exclusion in the planning environment. Needless to say, disability theory is often ignored in the planning contexts and even planning podcasts. So without further delay, we welcome Tim Ross. Welcome to Dense City.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Great. It's a pleasure.
I selected this paper because I was using it at work with a few colleagues, and I thought the whole world needed to learn about this paper and some of the theory behind how we do our planning. So tell me about the work that you do at EPIC Lab and planning and childhood disability to start.
Sure. So our research in the EPIC Lab is primarily focused on understanding how disabled children and their families experience different community spaces, systems, and services, as well as how they would change them to advance their own access and inclusion. So, you know, a lot of qualitative research looks at experiences. Yes, we want to do that, but we also really want to understand their ideas. What would they change? How would they do it? And so we do this with a view to meaningfully recognizing their agency and their expertise on their everyday lives in research and practice. Okay, we need their expertise. And so, as I mentioned, our research is primarily qualitative. We do a lot of interviews. We also use, increasingly, we're using arts-informed methods to support our inquiries, photo voice, draw and write activities, and more. And we've focus on four key topics, I guess you could say, education access, transport and mobility, inclusive play has been a big one lately, and institutional ableism.
What's inclusive play?
Sure. So inclusive play, I mean, the work we've been doing is looking at how we can enhance the design of playgrounds and actually develop fully inclusive playgrounds that welcome disabled children to play alongside and to integrate with their non-disabled peers on typical playgrounds. So we launched I think it's like 140 page report. It was sizable back in 2022, titled Creating Inclusive Playgrounds, a Playbook of Considerations and Strategies. And it goes through, you know, it's structured with four questions. How do we start? Can I get there? So it's, you know, transportation, pathways, parking, and so on. Can I play? Where we're looking at surface materials, play components, and more. And can I stay? Where we're actually thinking about, maybe we need to fold facilities and amenities surrounding playgrounds into the
That's
designs.
great. Yeah, I'll put that in the notes for sure. So then tell me about why you chose to write this paper, a more theoretical paper discussing different perspectives and different kind of models of how we think about disability.
Sure. So the idea for this paper came about through some discussions with my co-authors, Professors Ron Bewling, Tanya Tichkovsky, and Paul Hess. And so the discussions considered, just how deeply entrenched systemic inattention to disability is in planning, and correspondingly, how remarkably under-theorized disability is in planning research and practice. So, with respect to systemic inattention to disability and planning, I think it's fair to say it's readily apparent. Okay, for example, disability is largely absent from most professional planning program curricula. Disability representation is lacking among planning scholars and practitioners. Another example would be two scholars out of Dalhousie, Makiko Terashima and Kate Clark, wrote a great review piece, maybe it's a few years back now. Demonstrating that the planning literature also largely ignores disability, where they look at planning journals and how much they've published on disability, and it's minimal. The clearest, most tangible indication of systemic inattention to disability in planning would be the blatantly inaccessible planned environments that we have, and the fact that they're normalized. One of the questions we ask in the paper is, of the millions of people using inaccessible subway stations each day in global cities, how many ponder that the station designs, and thus the subway systems, may challenge and exclude people with physical, sensory, or developmental disabilities? And do people visiting inaccessible restaurants and shops acknowledge that these places are exclusionary to disabled people, the world's largest minority group? So if we think about these questions for, 5 seconds even, it starts to reveal how profoundly normalized the exclusion of disability remains. Okay, there's a lot of work. So, given this inattention with this paper, it's unsurprising but unfortunate that planning scholars and practitioners aren't learning about and embracing or digging into disability theory. And this kind of, sucks because engaging this theory could really enhance their work. And this work, the work of planning scholars and practitioners, it clearly influences how disability is experienced in our communities, right? Land use planning, transport planning, environmental planning, public engagement, and so on. So we need them to think about disability more. So we put together this article to, one, show the systemic inattention to disability in planning, and two, to show planning scholars and practitioners how engaging different disability perspectives can help them to think about and approach disability in different ways, all of which can actually help their planning practice. We explain five disability perspectives, provide examples of how each one can be useful, and call for planners to embrace the complexity of disability and to engage disability theory in their work.
So walk us through these five different perspectives, starting with the medical perspective.
Yeah, the medical model of disability, it so if this views disability as one's limitations resulting from bodily impairment. Okay, so it regards disability as an individualized issue, which allows disability to be subjected to little sociopolitical analysis and to be viewed as a personal tragedy. Okay. Now, this individualization can lead to normalized expectations that those with bodily impairments should come to terms with and overcome their difficult situations on their own or with support from, medical interventions or family members. The model ignores social and environmental conditions beyond the body, and it also doesn't really allow for the possibility of disability as a celebrated identity. And it also doesn't question problematic understandings of the normal body. So, unsurprisingly, this model has undergone a lot of criticism, really since the late 1970s when the social model emerged, which we'll get to. So for planners, I would say some are approaching disability primarily, if not entirely, through a medical model perspective, for those who haven't really engaged and questioned disability. And doing so may undercut their work, which is social in nature, right? It may undercut their efforts to produce accessible and inclusive communities that welcome and serve people of all abilities, because their focus is, if you're thinking about disability as an individual issue and not as something that's social, that doesn't align with work that's social in nature. While the medical model's criticisms and rejections have been warranted, I want to note, like, every model, every theoretical perspective has its criticisms, but it doesn't mean it doesn't have any use. So it could be useful in some cases for a planner. It could help a planner to understand bodily impairments in medical terms and diagnoses and interventions in some cases. So if a planner is tasked with preparing a consultation event for a mental health or a rehabilitation facility project, using a medical model in this case could help them to more fully understand the spatial and design needs of those with whatever you have, physical, sensory, intellectual, developmental impairments, who participate in the event, and those who will eventually use the space to be developed. Now, when I suggest using this model, I'm not suggesting planners take on a curative or restorative approach to disability. I'm just saying it might help make sure, they could produce an evented space for many bodies and not just some bodies. I'll give you one example of how, like, employing the medical model can be useful. And that's we've done some school travel research, and for one of these studies, we sought input from kids with osteogenesis imperfecta. So this is heightened level of bone fragility and regular bone fractures is associated with this condition. When we asked them about their trips, by focusing on, some of the issues associated with their condition, they indicated feeling scared of serious injury when traveling through crowds on school sites, when traveling over speed bumps built on and around school sites because the bumps in the bus can actually cause serious injury, and when using bus steps because that last step from the bus to the curb is really high and can jolt them. So by looking at the condition a little bit, we actually identified some planning issues that otherwise would have been missed.
Yeah, it'll be helpful when we discuss the social model and see where each differs. So, can you walk us through the social perspective and then how this takes off from the medical model and offers different kind of perspectives?
Sure. So it's very much oppositional to the medical model. It emerged in the late 70s in the UK when the UPIAS, Union of the Physically Impaired Against Segregation, they rejected the medical model's asocial and individualistic assumptions. And Michael Oliver refined this work, and I actually wrote down his definition because I think it's a nice one, where he notes, "Disability is all the things that impose restrictions on disabled people, ranging from individual prejudice to institutional discrimination, from inaccessible public buildings to unusable transport systems, from segregated education to excluding work arrangements, and so on. Further, the consequences of this failure do not simply and randomly fall on individuals, but systematically upon disabled people as a group who experience this failure as discrimination that is institutionalized throughout society." So this model rejects the medical model's asocial individualistic assumptions. It relocates disability from inside the body to outside the body as being caused by the barriers that are brought on by failures to adequately account for the presence and diversity of disability. And it suggests, and I think this is important, that disability doesn't randomly happen to someone. It's not a tragic event. It's something that happens systematically through our failures to account for disability. So this approach is useful to planners because it can help them to create a greater focus on identifying, eliminating, and preventing barriers in our planned spaces and planning processes, right? Whereas the medical model kind of undercuts that focus, this one facilitates it a bit more.
So then, using our school bus example, how would the social model change the area and design of the space?
Yeah, that's a nice question. I guess if we're thinking about let's say the children expressed concern and fear about bone fractures, injury, going over speed bumps, maybe we could cut gaps in the speed bumps or remove them as the traffic calming measure and use signage instead to reduce that. And with respect to that last step, from the bus to the curb, which is a bit too high for some of them, maybe there's something that we could do to the curb design to mitigate that, right? It's a stepping in and creating interventions in that way.
Yeah, it's great to see the difference of interventions depending on the disability perspective and lens that we're taking. So, next, there was the biopsychosocial model. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and how it differs and takes off from the social model?
Right. So we had the medical model dominate for a really long time. And then the social model in the late 70s started to be taken up more and is still used today. But as this progressed, calls emerged for more nuanced approaches to disability that engage matters beyond, the what is in the body and what is just, socially organized. What about identity, emotions, socio-spatial and political contexts? So biopsychosocial models, or BPS models, because I don't like saying biopsychosocial, they don't view disability in that binary way as caused by bodily impairment or by barriers. These models would view disability as arising from a combination of physical, the biological, emotional, the psychological, and environmental, the social. So its scope considers one's body, experiences and sentiments, how they're living, and the environment and social systems within which they're operating. So it's a bit more fulsome, I think you could say. This way of thinking actually underpins the World Health Organization's approach to disability, its International Classification of Functioning Disability and Health, or the ICF. Now the WHO's ICF, it's been criticized for creating a static approach to disability, when disability is always dynamic, and it's also been questioned because it doesn't question what constitutes normal bodies or normal health, which varies widely across geographies and cultures. So while, I mean, like other models, the BPS model has been criticized, but it could be useful to, a planner who's creating a consultation event, as they would be encouraged to question how people with different types of disabilities would physically and emotionally experience the event. Upon considering how an inaccessible event venue entrance could cause physical exclusion and unsafe, physical risks, it might also prompt, they might recognize that this could prompt negative emotional experiences, anger, frustration, sadness. And this might help the planner to more fully understand the importance of making sure the event is accessible, getting it right, and they might be more likely to act. So I think this perspective, by offering a bit more nuance, a more fulsome understanding of how disability is experienced, can help them to understand and appreciate that complexity and do better work as a
It's
result.
interesting that that model seems to, take into account it's not just getting through the door, but the event itself. And I'm just thinking about some of the things in the planning world and how it can trigger these emotional responses. Because, let's say I'm just trying to think of a development that's going in, or, some change that's happening in your community and how that may make you feel. And then how do you mitigate this at the event itself? It's not just, oh, everyone is here or everyone is not here. Kind of like the playground model and
Yeah.
having, can you play and can you enjoy the playground while you're there?
I might add, by folding in that emotional side of things, I think that can help planners move beyond just thinking about disability in relation to accessibility and think about disability in relation to inclusion, making sure people are feeling welcome, which would, of course, enhance participation and allow for more feedback at a planning event and so on. Yeah.
So then how does this neoliberal viewpoint, the next sort of perspective, tie in? And I know we're not going in this sort of sequential way. Like the models aren't necessarily, yeah, it's
Well,
kind of like
sharks.
a history, but you know, it's not to say that one is so much better than the next or
That's right.
there's
No,
no
there's
hierarchy.
no singular disability perspective that serves as a panacea. I think our intent here is to help planners to understand that, like, engaging disability theory and taking on a pluralistic approach to it, that we can draw on multiple perspectives to, and you know, in different ways, depending on our planning challenge and circumstances, to, you know, and I just think it can help us to think through and question how we're doing things, be and unsettle the status quo of how what our current approach is.
So then, with that, the can you touch on the next neoliberal viewpoint and how this might have give us a different perspective?
Sure, I'll preface this by noting that neoliberalism isn't exactly a disability perspective, right? But it affects how disability is experienced, so we felt it should be discussed in this paper. So neoliberalism, I mean, the economic policy approach that emphasizes free markets, deregulation, privatization, minimal state intervention. I'm probably missing a few descriptors. But it penetrates our culture and it holds sway in how our everyday lives are organized, including disability experiences. In particular, its emphasis on productivity has led to a neoliberal desire for sameness among humans. It's going to get a little interesting here.
Just a little meta, but I'm very much enjoying it.
Bear with me. So when we say a desire for sameness among humans, we're meaning humans who meet ableist, idealized, overly normative body types. Humans are autonomous, independent, work-ready, and productive. So disabled people lacking any combination of these abilities, who therefore don't fit this idealized mold, they may experience, and they do experience, varying degrees of exclusion in a world that desires and perhaps even demands normalized abilities. So as an example, I mentioned we're doing some work on supportive housing for people with developmental disabilities. In Canada right now, people with developmental disabilities are facing a supportive housing crisis as they're spending years, at times more than 10 years, on supportive housing wait lists, and the lists are growing longer. So this group's developmental diversity is arguably being viewed as beyond the scope of the hyper-normalized citizen concept that neoliberalism helps to perpetuate. And correspondingly, their housing needs have gone mostly unaccounted for in housing policy and the planning of communities. It's been in my opinion, it's been a huge miss in planning that this group's been ignored, causing remarkable challenges for the individuals, as well as, you know, parents who may be aging and want some downtime. So in the paper that we wrote, we note that we can view disability through a neoliberal economic workforce lens, right? As a person's inability to participate in the workforce and how this affects productivity and economic consequences. And it can also be viewed in a neoliberal market perspective. You know, disabled people in their networks are a large group of underserved consumers who value accessibility as a good or service. We note that thinking about disability in this way can help planners. Bear with me. I take this with a grain of salt. I'm going to contextualize this. It can help planners to understand how disability has bearing on economies and markets and vice versa. But, you know, what we suggest that planners can, in some cases, use a neoliberal economic or market rationale as a tactic for advocating for accessibility. So if a housing justice ar argument misses the mark with a certain audience, one could strategically communicate a neoliberal market perspective to encourage people to consider the serious need for supportive housing. There is a demand we should build. Planner could also educate the public in some cases on the economic and market potentials of advancing accessibility. We can improve retail, we can improve tourism. Accessible tourism is a rapidly growing sector. But, you know, we discuss these perspectives because they have influence on disability and that they can be used tactically. But I've got to note that it's imperative that we don't view disabled people solely in neoliberal terms. I can't emphasize this enough because doing so would devalue them as only employees and consumers, discount the intrinsic value of their contributions and personhoods, and kind of, cause disability to be viewed as commodified, which would suck. So we note it, if you're going to engage this perspective, do so carefully and tactically and keep other perspectives in mind. Don't use it, don't go solo with neoliberalism.
I often think that way with different transportation studies as well. It's are we from a neoliberal viewpoint, you're maybe creating economic gain along the street that you have nice parklets or bike lanes on, right? But is that a tactic or is that the sole reason you're creating bike lanes? No, hopefully not. But you're using it as like a tactic to argue that we should have bike lanes because of the economic growth, and that is used as a tool and a sort of tactic to saying yes to all the naysayers who say it will ruin their business and viability of the area.
We're noting that it's a prominent rationale. It's a prominent way of thinking. I mean, unfortunately, in some ways. But if with that being the case, there are some discussions to be had about disability and accessibility in relation to neoliberalism. That was a hard section to write.
Because it is such a default viewpoint and perspective of our society. And as planners, you'd hope that we not operate with only the economic lens and
Oh, please,
be
no.
doing things for the betterment of society, regardless of the cost. But, cost, it always comes down to how much money things cost. And, should that be our perspective? No. But is it something we have to consider? Because everything is constrained, right? And dealing with those
You're correct.
trade-offs is something to think about. So then walk us through this last critical ableist studies lens, which was more intriguing than the rest because it has the word critical in it. And I'm always drawn to anything that has the word critical in it.
So this perspective is, I mean, for me, I find it challenging, but I think it has a role and warrants some consideration from planners. So perspectives we've considered so far, they none of them do much in terms of questioning the normalcy of disability as excludable. Okay, the fact that this has become normalized in many ways, unfortunately. I think this normalcy plays a key role in the ongoing production of inequality in our planned environments. Okay, so few people would disagree that inaccessible exclusionary designs yield unacceptable experiences, right? So is it not then sensible to ask, how is it normal for people to regularly not notice or dismiss such designs and experiences? A critical ableist studies perspective, which emerges from the work of people like Gregor Wolbring, Fiona Kumari Campbell, and Dan Goodley, helps with this. Okay. It supports questions about ableism, which I should perhaps define, which, ableism can be understood. I don't know if I defined it already. It can be understood as a preference for certain abilities and a corresponding disregard for those lacking those preferred abilities in the simplest way I think it can be articulated. So this perspective helps us question ableism and its impact on normative order. It helps us to question how our shared normalized understanding of the human being discounts aspects of our bodily diversity in favor of an overly normative human being or body concept. Okay. And this overly normative human being or body concept, unfortunately, excludes disability from the scope of diversity, even though that's not the case. Disability is part of our bodily diversity. So It helps to question what my co-author Tanya Tichkovsky refers to, when she says disability in some ways is viewed as a justifiably excludable type. Okay. And to say disabled people are often viewed as a justifiably excludable type is rational, in my opinion, given the remarkable evidence we have in countless planned environments that overlook their difference. We have global cities that don't even have half of their stations accessible, subway stations, deeply unacceptable supportive housing wait lists. We still have curb cuts and pedestrian realm designs that are dangerous for wheelchair users or blind and partially sighted people. Just a few weeks back, we had, what was it, here in Toronto, a cycling path that was designed and built that is at the same grade as the pedestrian realm without any separation or tactile markers. So that means somewhat a blind individual using a cane could easily veer into the cycling path. I mean, this
Yeah,
shouldn't be
we've
happening.
been doing some work on like the sort of floating bus stops, right? Or bus boarding islands, and how, in this, speaking of constrained environments, in this small constrained environment where you're pitting pedestrians and cyclists and transit users all against each other because you're all vying for the smallest amount of space. How do you manage it being an accessible environment still when you're crossing paths, but if there's no tactile walking surface indicator surfaces, you don't know that you're maybe going into walking into a cycling path or how to get to the bus stop, and you've never seen that before. So
What you're mentioning is like that's a really complex planning challenge, right? And to navigate it and for us to do it right, we've got to think about how we're approaching disability, how we're engaging disabled people. Like how can we do this better to get this right? And so this is where questioning normalized practices in planning, normalized engagement, is it actually enough? Can we do better? I mean, the answer is yes. So the critical ableist studies perspective, it's useful for questioning normalcy. It's also valuable in that it embraces intersectionality. It acknowledges that to understand experiences of disability, we must also consider experiences of other forms of social difference, race, gender, income level, sexuality, age, and so on. And question how experiences of each can and do affect one another. It's not disability or race, it's disability and race, right? So I think it's a more complex perspective. I'm not gonna deny that. But I think it can equip planners, scholars, and practitioners to question their conceptualizations, their values, beliefs, their processes, and how they might include ableist elements. And if we don't question that, because I think ableist elements in our concepts, values, beliefs, we can kind of view those as like upstream issues that if we don't correct, we're going to manifest downstream issues in our, disabling barriers and the material conditions of
So
our
then
environment.
the ableist elements sort of beget the ableist outcomes. So when talking about the downstream effects, if we're not affecting how we do and how we behave in the sort of planning practice, then it will create these outcomes, whether we like it or not, because they weren't built into the system.
Yeah, one way I've discussed this before, I know, is we can use the social model to identify, eliminate, and prevent barriers for a long, long time. But if we don't go to that next level where we're questioning the normalcy of our practices, ableism in our thinking and values, those barriers are going to keep coming, right? So this approach can kind of help us get to that next level that I think can be really helpful in planning.
We've touched briefly on how each perspective can be used in planning practice. But what are your thoughts about maybe the methodologies that would be best suited, And in each of the perspectives, maybe how we can approach including this perspective in planning practice.
First of all, public engagement approaches need to be significantly more proactive with how they are engaging disabled people and groups, right? In some cases, you don't know that citizens living with disability are going to show up and be present at consultation events, especially given, they are dealing with accessibility difficulties that may extend beyond the venue. It could be getting public transit to the location. Are we actually thinking about that? So I think we need to do more about inviting disability advocacy groups, communicating it really effectively to them. And when we're doing that, we need to be mindful of the groups that are being contacted because these groups should represent the diversity of disability. Okay. It's not just about physical disability or one specific group. I think it's fair to say that planners are at times focusing a bit more on physical disability than other types of disability, which to some extent makes sense given the physical, aspects of planning work. But people who are blind or partially sighted, autistic individuals, an autistic individual with sensory sensitivities may benefit from engagement and improvements to their planned environment with respect to, sound dampening or lighting changes in transit stations. And so we can't view consultation with disabled people as if they're a homogenous group. We need to acknowledge that diversity and act accordingly and be much more proactive to make sure they are consistently present at events. Yeah. And offer multiple means of communicating
Right,
if,
right.
yeah.
And then after these events, how do you think like these perspectives should be incorporated into the plans? Is it throughout the plan? Is it a section of the plan? Kind of how does this work its way through the planning process to reality?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if there's a singular response, but one thing I know is, we're dealing with we have accessibility legislation being passed across provinces and associated accessibility standards, some of which planners need to be quite mindful of. And my preference would be to see, official plans sometimes engage disability at a high level, a vision statement or values, what have you, without necessarily providing explicit policy directions. And therefore, without those explicit policy directions, it might get missed in regulations, in zoning bylaws, and so on. But one of the bigger issues, actually, beyond just the documents, is we need to question how we're engaging accessibility policy and regulations and so on and standards. So it seems that we are at times treating minimum standards as if it's just a checkbox, it's a fixed standard. And planners, we've got to, like, in every single circumstance, we need to think critically about if and how these standards should be excluded. A good example is if you've got, let's say, an accessible parking ratio regulation in a zoning bylaw, and the ratio is 1 to 25 spaces, one accessible to 25 typical spaces. But you have, let's say, my work, you have an inclusive playground nearby. Clearly, it makes sense to exceed that ratio, right? If you're trying to create an inclusive playground, you want multiple families living with childhood disability or adulthood disability to be able to be present together. So we can't do checklist accessibility because it can lead to technically accessible environments, but environments that are functionally inaccessible. And a really clear example of this is in our school travel research, we discovered, and we wrote a paper on this actually, all about the experiences of parking at school, that some school sites are being planned and laid out, their parking is technically accessible, but it's functionally inaccessible because they put the accessible parking spaces near the front doors where they should. That's great. But during drop-off and pickup times, the busiest time of day, the buses park right in front of the accessible parking spaces. So those technically accessible parking spaces are rendered inaccessible at the two times of day when they're needed. So this is, you know what I mean? We got to think about experience and do a bit better.
It's good to outline that we need to move from checking a box, making a minimum standard, being technically accessible to in reality accessible. And how do we bridge the gap between technically and actually? Yeah, because it's hard to make these standards for just normalized, the average person. It's easy to make those standards, but when we're including a diversity of people, there is a diversity of needs. It's very wide, the needs.
And it's there's I don't know how to advance it, but I think there has to be something where where planners are working toward or questioning how they're engaging standards, such that it that those quick checking of the box logic is that's not it. It has to be using it as a tool to think critically about the site.
And using the professional judgment to say, does this make sense? To stop and say, does this make sense? But as you outlined earlier, maybe you're not even thinking about it because you didn't have a class in planning school or in engineering school to understand these experiences or to even have it on your radar. So yeah, it's within the system as well that we're systematically ignoring.
I think that's slowly changing. Actually, my co-author Ron Bueling is teaching the first disability focus course in planning at University of Toronto right now. So it's great.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to chat with you.
Awesome. Great. Have a good
Great.
rest of
You
the
as well.
day. That's it for now, and thank you so much for listening. A big thanks to Dr. Timothy Ross for joining us on this episode. Follow the link in the show notes to read the paper we spoke about today. You can also learn more about the EPIC Lab, which stands for Engagement Planning Inclusive Communities Lab, at Bloorview Research Institute at the link in the show notes. And follow Tim on Twitter at ThisIsTimRuss and HB Kids Hospital and LinkedIn at TimRuss. Be sure to share and subscribe for updates on future episodes. Feel free to contact me on Twitter at DensityPod to keep the conversation going. A special thanks to Emily Huang of Emily H. Illustrations for creating the artwork for this podcast. You can check out more of her work by following the link in the show notes. Another thanks to Ryan Kinnear and Reed Kai for the show music. See you next time on Dense City Podcast.